Now, it is not our duty, nor our need tonight, to explore the extent to which the Illuminati were responsible for or contributed to bringing on the French Revolution with all of its excesses and reign of terror. The evidence increases that this part was powerful and extensive. More important, if there were time, would be a discussion of the methods used, especially to excite and manipulate the Paris mobs, on which mobs the successful destructiveness wreaked on the state, on religion, and on all morality depended. All was lies, planned agitation, and mob action, murders carefully plotted to appear as spontaneous vengeance by the people, incredible terror used as a political weapon, all in the name of reason and of liberty, equality, and brotherhood. The French Revolution turned out to be, in fact, a rehearsal in almost every particular of what the whole world is facing today. Compressed into one city and a period of 6 years, 1789 through 1794, were all of the lies and crimes and horrors and propaganda and destructiveness which are now being applied to the whole world over a period of about 6 decades. Whether the top command of the international communist conspiracy is simply a continuing part of Weishaupt's Illuminati under whatever names and in whatever forms it may have perpetuated itself, we do not know. As Dr. Oliver has pointed out, we do know that Karl Marx wrote the Communist Manifesto in 1847 simply as an agent employed by one such group, the so-called League of Just Men, which already had branches in many countries long before it was renamed as the League of Communists. My own lesser researches clearly indicate that the infamous so-called German Union and other revolutionary bodies with exactly the same purposes and methods as the Illuminati, which helped the identified Weishaupt Illuminati mightily in bringing on the French Revolution, that they were nothing more nor less than divisions or branches of the Illuminati, which had been set up separately for purposes of deception, protection, and convenience. It could easily be that the League of Just Men was just a division of the Illuminati, that Karl Marx and after him Trotsky and Lenin and Stalin and Malenkov and de Gaulle and Castro and Nehru and Betancourt and hundreds of other leftist leaders elsewhere throughout the world and a dozen in this country whom we had better leave unnamed, have all been working for such an inner group, or in some cases have been members of it. We do not know. It doesn't matter enough to deserve more than passing attention or speculation in the struggle we are in today. What does matter, and the point to which this whole speech has been leading so far, is that the forces of evil which work through collectivism are always organized, while the opposing forces of good, which support and defend the rights and responsibilities of individuals, are always disorganized. And this seems to me the primary reason, above all other reasons, why it sometimes takes so long for the forces of good, with all truth on their side, to come out from under the slavery or suppression or ignominy to which they are recurrently subjected for a generation or for a century by the forces of evil. Throughout all of the history, which we reviewed so briefly at the beginning of this talk, the forces of evil have been organized for every fray. The forces of good have never been organized, except during those last-ditch, often suicidal, but sometimes successful spasms of effort to throw off a collectivist tyranny when enough individuals had finally come to recognize that tyranny as unbearable. And now we face an extension of this principle, which makes it tremendously more important. For in our contemporary world, the forces of evil are not only more elaborately and tightly and lastingly organized than ever before, and not only do they have the benefit of an organization which has visibly been continuous and growing for many decades, but whether or not this organization is merely a continuation of one which has been active for nearly 200 years, it has obviously taken full and remarkable advantage of the accumulated knowledge and experience of collectivist groups which have been active throughout that whole period. The Communist Party of Khrushchev does not have to be a direct organizational descendant of Weishaupt's Illuminati to be able to benefit from everything the collectivists learned from their manipulation and use of, let's say, that incredibly slimy hypocrite Mirabeau, or of the equally nauseating, though far less brilliant traitor, the Duc d'Orléans, in steering the French Revolution onto the course that the Illuminati had designed. The very fact that both Mirabeau and the Duc d'Orléans were members of the Illuminati, as they were, although not trusted members and only half illuminated, and hence to be treated as members as long and only as long as they were useful and then tossed to the wolves. This very fact, these and many other such experiences and accomplishments of Weishaupt and his inner circle can supply the top communist command today with many guidelines as how to deal with a Juan Bosch or a John Goulart or a Juan Perón, while the anti-communists of the world simply do not have and never have had any organizational continuity which gives the slightest chance of even learning about and much less utilizing the experiences from past encounters which are repeated over and over and over. As one of my associates has said, the communists have missed nothing, absolutely nothing, among all the possibilities for deception, propaganda, and aggression in any and all situations which may arise. While the anti-communists appear to have learned absolutely nothing from the past, I have never seen an anti-communist who even recognized the incredible similarities between the characters, careers, and utterly false historical legends of Cornelia, the mother of the Gracchi, and of Eleanor Roosevelt. I've never seen one that recognized in Alcibiades such an instructive prototype of a couple of our recent very distinguished political leaders in this country. I have never seen one who pointed out the unbelievably numerous and extensive parallels between the Spartan state during the Peloponnesian War and the USSR during the war we are fighting today. But the communists, ladies and gentlemen, obviously learned directly from the story of Sparta or from organizations which have passed this knowledge on to the contemporary communists that the family must be weakened and then destroyed as a sociological unit by any totalitarian collectivist regime. And it is the very fact that the individualists will learn nothing from history, have no organizational means or opportunity of learning anything from history, which so helps the collectivists to perpetrate repetitions of tragic history on us again and again. All of which discussion and background leads us, as you are certain to have been surmising, to the John Birch Society. For we feel that it is clearly our duty and may be our destiny to fill this void. And bringing out what we mean in this connection will give me an opportunity to repeat, clarify, or emphasize two or three other basic principles and purposes of the Society. In the last pages of the Blue Book, as simply a transcript of what was said at the founding meeting of the Society, it is pointed out that I think the John Birch Society is something new in history. I still think so. And this speech has been intended partly to explain and support the thought. Because this is the first time in history, so far as we know, that any sizable group of truly good men and women of all religious beliefs and of all races and colors has ever been brought together in any permanent voluntary organization to work as a group for those things which they believe in common. There are several basic reasons why this kind of association has never been achieved before. The first is that good men and women are necessarily those who believe in the responsibility of the individual and who are therefore individualistic in their thinking. They instinctively realize the truth of Kipling's lines that the ill ye do by two and two ye must pay for one by one, and that the individual can take credit for his own good deeds but not for those of the crowd. As individualists, the truly good men and women are reluctant to merge themselves into any secular body where close ties with others who may have divergent views might call for defenses or compromises of their own beliefs. But we have overcome that obstacle by our insistence that we do not even want men and women whose characters and personal beliefs have rounded edges. We want their membership in the John Birch Society to strengthen and solidify their beliefs, The whole key to our working together is tolerance, not compromise. We must agree, of course, basically on morality, integrity, and purpose, and on the fundamental goals of the society, which are less government, more responsibility, and a better world. Otherwise, there would be no point in our coming together, and there is no reason for anybody not subscribing to those principles to join our great undertaking. But it is obvious today that there are enough people who agree with these basic principles and with our organizational plans for their support to make of the John Birch Society a permanent and growing body, one in which the forces of good can maintain a lasting union and a continuing concerted effort. We believe, therefore, as already stated, that for this reason and in this manner, the John Birch Society can become a new force in human history, one that has been very badly needed, especially for the past 200 years, and that as such a new force, it can become a very effective factor on the side of the forces of good in making this a better world. For at least not all of the advantages of organization and of continuity will now be left on the side of the forces of evil. Not all of the forces of evil, nor all evil men, use the tools or pressures of collectivism to serve their selfish purposes. The bank robber, the man who kills the husband of his mistress, the man who is such a liar that he develops the best memory in the county in order to keep up with his falsehoods. These may even be individualists. In fact, as a boy in Democratic North Carolina, I heard on reliable authority that horse thieves had even been known to vote the Republican ticket. And we regard bank robbers, murderers, liars, and horse thieves as enemies of the John Birch Society, and in fact as enemies of all society, even if and when such criminals do happen to be conservatives with a strong penchant for laissez-faire. So collectivism is not our only enemy, but we are permanently, eternally, and completely opposed to collectivism as either a political philosophy or an activist conspiracy. On the contemporary scene, we refer to the conspiratorial collectivists as communists. Obviously, we must stop these conspirators from gradually imposing their system on the rest of mankind, and we must rout the conspiracy before we can move forward with our long-range constructive purposes. But the important point here is that we are also opposed to all collectivists, including the present-day communists, even on the philosophical plane. For we seek less government, more responsibility, and a better world. The collectivists, on the other hand, are always and everywhere striving for more government and less individual responsibility. And the communists today are also doing their utmost to bring about a completely amoral world. In this fight on both levels, we have a twofold job. One is simply to carry on a continuous and increasingly large-scale educational program. Even for our now raging fight against the communists, education is our basic strategy and truth is our only weapon. Did it ever occur to you to wonder why, with the John Birch Society no larger than it is, and having absolutely no official standing or support, the communist periodicals in Moscow, which lay down the line for the communists everywhere else to follow, have devoted more space to smearing the John Birch Society than they have ever given to any other non-official enemy in the whole 40 years of their lying propaganda? Well, I can tell you many reasons, but one most important reason. It is that we offer a new kind of opposition. Nowhere else in any of the 50 countries the communists have already taken over have they ever had to contend with a sizable organization of patriots which was dedicated simply to the principle of bringing out the truth. The communists do not fear arms or armies. In most of the world, even the so-called remaining free world, they control too many of the men who would have to give the order to march. The communists do not fear the bombs and missiles of push-button warfare. In most cases, they now own the men who would have to push the buttons. They do not fear purely political action. In every country, they have proved their ability under all circumstances to control and stultify purely political action and mold it to their purposes. But the communists seek to impose and maintain their tyranny in any country with only about 3% of that country's population. Obviously, this could not be done if even 50% of the population understood what was happening. All it would take to stop and rout the communists in our own country completely in 3 months, ladies and gentlemen, would be for enough Americans to become aware of what the communists are doing and how they are doing it. The necessary political action, through impeachments, through votes in Congress, through the actions of state legislatures and governors, through special elections and regular elections at every level, would follow so fast it would make your head swim. And it would make the communists put their tails between their legs and scamper to their kennels. And of course, the communists know it. I only wish even our own members knew it half so well. So it is our aim to become a huge and deeply dedicated educational army. We already are. It's our aim to become a much larger one. But we also have a second task on which the first one in many opportunities and events in the future will all depend. And that is simply to establish and maintain ourselves as a continuing organization of unshakable loyalty to the principles for which our great body came into existence. We shall thus be on hand at our rallying point whenever the collectivists arrive at one of those pages of future history where the weakness of good men and the parallel strength of organized evil men combine to give these forces of evil an opportunity to come out on top once again. Let's make this whole thought clearer by specific illustrations. I most emphatically believe that if there had been in Athens during the 5th century B.C., a John Birch Society of just its present size, all Greece would have been spared the destructive horror of the Peloponnesian Wars. I am equally certain that had there been in Western Europe during all of the last half of the 18th century, a John Birch Society of just its present dedicated strength, France would have been spared the 6-year brutalizing terror and cruelties of the French Revolution. But there simply was no permanent, organized, continuing force in either instance to expose or offset the lies and pretenses and agitation of the contemporary versions of our present-day communists. On the current scene today, the collectivist forces of evil are incredibly more extensive, more tightly organized, more experienced, more skillfully directed, and more solidly entrenched than they were in either Greece or Western Europe, right up to the actual Holocaust of either time and place. So we are well aware that the John Birch Society has to become a great deal larger and stronger, and to do so fast, if we are to help decisively in preventing an exactly similar Holocaust from engulfing our own country. But this does not alter the value of our concept. It merely makes us lament that the John Birch Society was not founded 30 years sooner and more determined in our effort to catch up to the need. Both for the present colossal battle and for the long struggle ahead, we must keep our basic approach and objectives of a constructive nature. This doesn't mean any lack of defensive, preventive, or curative action against the communist infection or against the whole disease of collectivism. When a physician cuts out a tumor or prevents smallpox by vaccination, his particular action may be negative or defensive, but it is certainly part of a constructive activity and purpose. Communism today, far from being any wave of the future, one of the two great lies of communism, far from being any wave of the future, is simply a huge dirty boil on the body of mankind. Like any boil, it is very painful, and it is seeping poisons all through the body. It badly needs to be lanced and drained so that the whole body can be restored to normal health with as small a permanent scar and as few lasting effects as possible. The concern of the doctor when lancing and draining a boil is the health of the body which had become infected. But a good physician will also do all he can to insist on cleanliness and proper living to prevent boils and to make the body of his patient more healthy, both before and after cutting out or curing any particular result of unhealthy living. And the analogy holds all the way for ourselves in doing our part as a physician towards giving the whole body of mankind a healthier mind in a healthier body. It is this imperative need for positive, aggressive, constructive thinking and action and purpose which is the real theme of all I am saying to you or trying to say tonight. In the Blue Book, 5 years ago, if you'll forgive me for quoting, it's on page 122 for our members here, I stated my conviction that we could never win even this immediate current battle with the communists, quote, unless the promise of what we can build supplies more motivation than the terror of what we must destroy. And this speech tonight has been prepared primarily to re-emphasize that conviction. All of the rest of it has been intended as prelude to these final paragraphs. And the easiest way to make their purport clear is to look once again at the present battle from a few different specific viewpoints. First, the communists have been striving for the past 50 years to destroy, utterly and permanently, the three basic human loyalties. These are loyalty to God, loyalty to country, and loyalty to family. The communists simply must do so in order to become and remain victorious, for no permanent and completely totalitarian regime could possibly permit any loyalty other than to itself. While the communists' intended destruction of all religion is underway, they make as much use as they can of the organizational structure of religious bodies as a means of reaching large numbers of good men and women with subtle propaganda most favorably presented. They infiltrate the clergy of various denominations. Our job, however, is not just to expose and defend against this propaganda and infiltration, but to make the impact of real religion on our national life even stronger. Put in the broadest and most comprehensive language, we must counter all of the blasphemy, apostasy, and sacrilege being promoted around us by doing our part to let more of reverence in us dwell. And within that broad purpose, we need in our own lives to make our own personal religious beliefs into closer, firmer guides for our actions and our consciences. And may I say that in all of these respects, our members are doing wonderfully well indeed. Among the greatest encouragements that we constantly find on the quite rough road we are now traveling are the hundreds of letters from our Catholic, Protestant, and Jewish members alike, telling us that their work in, dedication to, and understanding of the John Birch Society has caused their religion to come to mean more to them than ever before. There's not a week goes by that we don't get many such letters. As to patriotism, everybody who could tell Khrushchev from Smokey the Bear knows how intrinsically imperative a feature of communism is its completely international structure and character. Despite the communist use of a flamboyant new pseudo-nationalism in formerly colonial areas, during the brief transition period while a Ghana or a North Vietnam or a Congo is being converted from a British, French, or Belgian colony into a Soviet colony, and despite a few recurrent and very useful feuds, such as the supposed one going on now between China and Russia themselves, feuds based on the fraud of nationalistic divisions within the communist family, nevertheless, it is perfectly obvious that the communists must do everything they can to destroy all real patriotic sentiment as rapidly as possible. Now, we need to counter this drive not just by defending our independence from subtle attempts to convert the very phrase into interdependence. And remember, the last two presidents of the United States both used the 4th of July, the day in honor of our independence, to make a speech glorifying the interdependence of the United States. But we need not only to counter that and to do all we can to counter all efforts to merge our nation into a one-world tyranny. We must seek at all times and everywhere to make our fellow citizens constantly more aware of the material, political, and spiritual accomplishments of our nation, of the greatness of its heroes, of its once glorious promise as the last best hope of man, and of the tremendous destiny that still awaits it as both a physical and a spiritual leader among the nations of the future. We must be willing not only to die for our country if that ultimate need arises, And in accordance with a noble tradition of mankind which the communists have not yet been able to uproot, but we need to live for our country to the extent that the example and the produce of our daily lives can contribute to its greatness as a home for ourselves, our children, and their descendants. All of which makes this a fitting place for just a word about politics. Clearly, as good citizens in a great country where it is still theoretically and legally possible to make those who govern us responsible to the will of the governed, we must ourselves live up to the responsibility which that privilege imposes. Our policy, therefore, must not be to eschew political campaigns and political action at all, but simply to make them more fruitful and more worthwhile. We should use the wonderful opportunities offered by a political campaign as a means of enlightening ourselves and our fellow citizens on the issues and the leadership that are determining our future. And we should do all we can to see that candidates make full use of that same opportunity. The society itself, for obvious reasons, can and does take no official part or position in any partisan political campaign. But our members should and do not only take part, they should, by both their example and labors, raise the whole level of political campaigns to their proper place in the kind of republic our founding fathers tried to have us inherit and maintain. As to the third loyalty, as to family loyalties, the communists are hacking away at this obstacle to their tyranny, by every conceivable means, from the eroding propaganda of television, stage, and screen, to the examples being set by top-flight national leaders who count on communist support. The direction of their effort is shown by what they have been able to accomplish in Russia. There, the child does not look to his parents, nor feel any gratitude to his parents, for the food he eats, the clothes he wears, the room in which he lives, the education he receives, or the pleasures and entertainments he is allowed. The child looks solely to the state as the provider of all of these blessings. The transference of loyalty there is begun early, and it is made as complete as practical and political considerations will yet permit. And parallel to this movement, of course, has been a destruction of the sanctity of marriage and of as many as possible of the countless ties that bind the family together as a sociological unit. Now, it is in the family circle that the feminine half of mankind's basic partnership justly earns credit for so large a part in human progress. The day-after-day influence of the mother in the family, through the exercise of love and patience and discipline and understanding, and through the inculcation into the children of ambition and generosity and a moral code and a sense of responsibility, it is this composite influence of all the mothers of any generation which has tremendous bearing on the position and the direction of the next generation. Goethe says, "Ewig weibliche zieht uns hinan," the eternal womanly draws us on, and it is certainly through the family that the eternal feminine makes its greatest contribution to the upward reach of all mankind. Now here again, it is not only our duty to resist the whole collectivist drive to destroy the family and to establish government in loco parentis. We must not only defend the family ideal against all of the pressures and propaganda which would destroy it, but we must strengthen that ideal and increase still further the ties and loyalties that make family units the very bricks out of which a stable and happy society is built. And now, solely for the sake of making our meaning clearer, let's turn for illustrations to more specific points. Let me say, ladies and gentlemen, I am almost through. For the sake of making our meaning clearer, let's turn for illustrations to more specific points of dispute. Let us remember that many of these objectives I shall mention, little or large, are not possible today, and most of them will not be easy at any time. These are ends to be sought and opportunities to be seized through an unceasing remembrance of our larger goals, of which these are comparatively small components. They are not assignments for which you punch a time clock every morning. It is not enough for us to take the first one. It's not enough for us to try to prevent the further expansion of government. We must constantly try to reduce the size of the government that we have. For the whole key to the problem of government, ladies and gentlemen, is not its character, nor is it in its form, but in its quantity. There is simply no way in which you can make big government, extensive government, behave. The only way to accomplish the desired result is also the simplest way. Keep government or reduce government to the absolute minimum. So this is one reason, of course, why we should give a round of applause to the promoters of the Liberty Amendment. And I bring this out, to say, for the sake of an illustration that's specific. For there you have a determined, single-purpose drive to reduce the size of government by removing some of the funds that support a profligate bureaucracy. For another illustration, it's not enough for us to resist and condemn the deliberate inflation of our currency by government. We must fight for a return to a gold-backed, completely redeemable, unmanaged currency. And the most important word in that sentence, ladies and gentlemen, far more important than gold or redeemable, is the word unmanaged. Some years ago, we published an article by Hans Setholz, a very brilliant disciple of von Mises, on the Federal Reserve System. Setholz was aware, as are many in this audience today, but as most of the American people never have been, that the kind of control over money exercised through the Federal Reserve System was one of the cardinal planks in the whole Marxian program. Like the graduated income tax and other lesser parts of the same program, it was imposed on the American people by highly placed Marxian influences in the Woodrow Wilson administration. And Setholz ended his compacted survey with the conclusion that, despite the very best of intentions on the part of a preponderant majority of all the officials of the system, without the Federal Reserve, the United States could not be dragged into socialism, while with the Federal Reserve, socialism could not be avoided. Now, a friend of mine sent a copy of this article to the head of one of the Federal Reserve banks. He, in turn, had an answer written by one of the bright young bureaucrats in his banking empire. And that answer began with this sentence, quote, "Somebody has to manage money. It certainly will not manage itself," unquote. Which meant that you could just throw the rest of the paper in the wastebasket as so much junk. Either unconsciously or deliberately, the young expert had completely missed the whole point. For it is only to the extent that money is not made the tool of the value judgments or of the political ambitions or of the ideological purposes of the planners that money serves its basic purpose. It is only to the extent that money is unmanaged and is a completely passive medium that it becomes so useful a common denominator into which to convert and through which to exchange the infinite results of man's productivity and the measures of his desires. In fact, ladies and gentlemen, and this is demonstrable, the freedom of money from management runs remarkably parallel throughout all history to the freedom of man himself from collectivist tyranny, and we must fight for both freedoms at every turn. Third, it's not enough for us to condemn the present increasing centralization of our schools and the extension of that tendency into a drive for the federalization of all education. We must do more. We must seek constantly to provide better local schools and a better understanding of how much their advantages outweigh the loss of efficiency supposedly provided by centralization. A decade ago, a few very able industrialists and an equal number of able educators, with myself as a very small fish in that pond, gathered repeatedly throughout 2 years in all-day meetings to hammer out a document which finally ran to 32 printed pages. But the whole core of that document, to which we wanted the educators to agree, of which we wanted them to become convinced, and to which we wanted them to put their names, and to which they did finally agree, much to their own amazement, was the statement that in America, the education of youth is the ultimate responsibility of their parents. And that under the United States Constitution, the largest and highest governmental body, which can thus act as an agency for the parents, is a state government. Despite all of the deliberately unconstitutional violations of that principle, which we see around us today, it is just as sound now as it was then. And we should work at every opportunity to return all educational units and facilities to circumstances in which their responsiveness to the will of the parents is more significant and more obvious. We should also do all we can to restore among parents a conscious sense of their own responsibility for the education, training, and attitudes given to their children by the agencies to which they have delegated their own duties. For again, all other freedoms, as best shown by the illustration in reverse in ancient Sparta and in Soviet Russia today, all other freedoms run quite parallel to the extent that education can be kept diffused, decentralized, subject to the infinite small fluid errors of differing groups instead of the few huge petrified errors of centralized government, and can be kept free from the use of education by such central power as a weapon of its tyranny. Now, there are in my notes a dozen more illustrations of similar purport taken from every division and activity of our national life. But I was sure by the time I got to this point, even in writing this speech, that the time had come to wind it up. So let's do so with dispatch. In this warm war now, which is rapidly getting warmer, and in all of the cold wars, tepid wars, and even hot wars of the long future, between the collectivist forces of evil and the individualistic forces of good, the John Birch Society must contribute organizational strength and firm leadership along the lines clearly indicated by our upward reach. We must oppose secrecy with open-handedness. We must publish to the world our beliefs, our purposes, and our methods as fully as the collectivists conceal and disguise their own. We must oppose conspiracy, not with counter-conspiracy, but with exposure, justice, and education. We must oppose falsehoods with truth, blasphemy with reverence, foul means with good means, immorality and amorality with more spiritual faith and dedication, rootlessness and chaos with tradition and stability, relativity with absolutes, pragmatism with deeper purposes, hedonism with a more responsible pursuit of happiness, cruelty with compassion, and hatred with love. We must oppose the collectivists in every way, because both their methods and their purposes are diametrically contrary to our own. But above all, we must oppose their willful destructiveness of all we have inherited, with an equally strong and creative determination to improve and enrich that inheritance. We must be constant and conscious helpers in the building of more beautiful, more permanent, and more useful structures in the physical, the political, and the spiritual areas of association and joint effort with our fellow men. As is well known to some of you, I have much love for poetry. And I am not deterred in the least from quoting verses of the 19th century poets because they are ridiculed by the superficial sophisticates of today as didactic or commonplace or outmoded. The Ten Commandments and the Sermon on the Mount are the two most hackneyed pieces of literature in a score of languages, but they are still rated pretty high by several hundred million people. So let me try to wrap up our thoughts for this evening for you in a leading sequence of three or four extracts from some widely scattered poetic sermons of a century ago. The first is from Tennyson, with a passing tribute to an earlier poet. I hold it truth with him who sings to one clear harp in divers tones, that men may rise on stepping stones of their dead selves to higher things. Then let's go to a dream many of us have of a golden age to be achieved through more individual responsibilities on higher tablelands of freedom than we have ever reached before. John Ruskin painted it for us. Awake, awake, the stars are pale, the east is russet gray. They fade, behold the phantoms fade that keep the gates of day. Throw wide the burning valves and let the golden streets be free. The morning watch is past, the watch of evening shall not be. Put off your mail, ye kings, and beat your brands to dust. A surer grasp your hands must know, your hearts a better trust. Nay, bend the back the lance's point, and break the helmet bar. A noise is on the morning winds, but not the noise of war. For aye, the time of wrath is past, and near the time of rest. And honor binds the brow of man, and faithfulness his breast. Behold, the time of wrath is past, and righteousness shall be. And the wolf is dead in Arcady, and the dragon in the sea. And at last, to the exhortation of Dr. Holmes, which served as our text tonight, and the title of this speech, which I'm not sure was even quoted, More Stately Mansions, and which last stanza here we like to think of as applicable to our individual selves, to the John Birch Society, and indeed to all mankind. Build thee more stately mansions, O my soul, as the swift seasons roll. Leave thy low-vaulted past. Let each new temple, nobler than the last, shut thee from heaven with a dome more vast, till thou at length art free, leaving thine outgrown shell by life's unresting sea. And finally, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very, very much for being so patient with me, letting me run over, and may God be with you till we meet again.